Hello and welcome to the Respiratory Exchange podcast. I'm Rai Dwake, chairman of the Respiratory Institute at Cleveland Clinic. This podcast series of short, digestible episodes is intended for healthcare providers and covers topics related to respiratory health and disease. My colleagues and I will be interviewing experts about timely and timeless topics in the areas of pulmonary, critical care, sleep, infectious disease, and related disciplines. We will share information that will help you take better care of your patients today, as well as the patients of tomorrow. I hope you enjoy today's episode.
Well, hello. My name is Stephen Gordon. I'm chairman of the Department of Infectious Diseases. And in this podcast, it's a pleasure for me to welcome a colleague and a friend, Dr. Ronan Factora, who's a geriatrician here at the Cleveland Clinic. And the topic today we're discussing is focusing in particular on the new RSV vaccine for the elderly. But before we delve into there, Ronan, I wonder if you can just give us your narrative and explain to our audience what a geriatrician does and what your passion for this is.
Thanks, Steve, for the intro, and it's a pleasure to be here. So geriatrician is a physician who takes care of people, technically 65 and older. But you know, our focus often is on issues that can affect independence. And often that runs the gamut of cognitive issues, physical frailty, mobility issues, the impact that a person's medical problems have on their ability to be independent and live the life that they want. We're really focused on preserving that function, preserving that independence. So it's not so much about treating the disease or diseases in general, but how that impacts your ability to live the life that you want. And we try to mitigate the impact that an illness may have on your independence and try to focus on independence and quality of life. That's really what a geriatrician does.
Well, thank you for that. And as I think as we're looking now in demography here in the States, the boomers are now entering what we would say the golden years. And so obviously this population is front and center in so many ways. And I think for us, you know, our focus is obviously now on respiratory viruses. All of us have now come off of what we'd say 4 years from the initiation of SARS-CoV-2, the pandemic. We're in the post-pandemic era. But yet there's a lot of lessons I think we learned. And, you know, as I reflect back, Ronan, if you look at whom the highest mortality was, clearly it was in the elderly. And clearly it was in the long-term care facilities. You know, as we look back, I think estimates are somewhere around 200,000 deaths in our residents of long-term care facility. So I just, can you help us explain the why there in terms of why our elderly are viewed as a vulnerable population for respiratory viruses and RSV in general?
So yeah, I think there are lessons from COVID are striking. And I think that it highlights that, you know, as a person gets older, there are certainly changes in a person's ability to fight off infections, you know, all sorts, you know, in this case, COVID, and be able to recover. So it's not just about fighting off the illness, but what happens after the illness actually goes through you, and what are you like after you go through the illness? So, you know, you'll see individuals really at higher risk, not just based on age, because we understand that, but when a person has a lot more physical frailties, more cognitive impairment, more physical issues, then their ability to fight off and recover from that is also impaired. And then, you know, it's not just a number when a person gets older, but all the things that you pick up along the way, that's what I say. And those are all the medical problems that you accumulate over time, heart disease, heart failure, COPD, diabetes. And there are a lot of individuals who are older who accumulate multiple diseases as a part of their life. Now, all of those factors can predict how well you are able to fight off an illness and what you do afterwards. Because, you know, the big concern for a lot of people who are older, it's not so much living longer, but living well. And losing that ability to be able to move as well as before, the ability to think, the ability to be independent, the reliance on family members to do more for you that you were able to do before, that's a big deal for many of my patients. And they want to be able to retain as much of that independence and ability as possible to enjoy their life. So when you're thinking about any illnesses that may occur along the way, particularly, you know, these seasonal illnesses, respiratory illnesses, it's not just about whether or not a person is going to get sick, but how are they going to be able to live the life that they want to, you know, when they're able to recover from it.
Well, thank you. Well, I know you do a lot of non-pharmacologic interventions because one of the things in your population is falls and unintentional injuries for the bars and in mobility, as you said. But I wondered if you can review the vaccines that you deal with, in particular the respiratory virus vaccines, you know, why RSV? I mean, people will tell us, oh, RSV, I haven't either heard of it, or isn't that for kids?
Right, absolutely. So as part of routine practice, we always recommend standard set of vaccinations that are recommended by the CDC as a way to avoid respiratory illnesses in persons who are older, particularly those who are frail. So pneumonia vaccines, you know, they've been around for a long time. We know that they prevent a number of different bacterial illnesses. You know, it's not going to be all of them, but we have a way to actually reduce the risk of getting bacterial illness, which for people who are older, lands you in the hospital, can kill you, and then can lead to disability. Influenza, flu vaccines, been around for a long, long time. And I think that we understand the cycle that, you know, flu gets worse later in the year, cold months, and then there's a peak period. You know, there, we also understand that we kind of identify which strains of the viruses are going to be most likely to cause illness, and that's what the vaccine protects you against. And much like the pneumonia vaccines, again, preventing respiratory illness, hospitalizations, and the sequela after that. COVID, very much the same way. You know, newer evolution, newer illness that we run into, and, you know, lots of problems related to this for sure, but still something that we can actually address with a vaccine that can reduce the risk of hospitalization, severe illness, much the same way that we work to prevent the flu and pneumonia. And then, you know, as with any medical evolution and advance, you know, we've now identified the RSV as one viral illness that has already been known to produce significant impacts on persons who are older, and especially if you have medical problems like heart failure and COPD. And we have a vaccine that can provide the same type of protection as we have had historically with COVID, with flu, and pneumonia. So you have one more tool to protect yourself against an illness that can really cause problems for you, now, not just in your overall health, but in your function. So as I talk to my patients, you know, that's one more tool to add in the armamentarium to help to protect them from illnesses that affect the thing that's most important to them, and that's independence. So should consider it.
Well, thank you for that. And I know if you look at the CDC and look at the what we would say the estimated incidence of cases that are medically attended in the elderly each year, it's upward to about 170,000 with almost 10,000 deaths attributed to RSV. And I think to your point, influenza, obviously we know about seasonality. And in a recent CDC study, I think where they looked at both viruses and the impact in 2022-2023 respiratory season, although RSV did not cause the incidence cases of medically attended, the cases were generally more severe. I wonder, as a clinician, can you explain to the audience, can you tell the difference between RSV, SARS-CoV-1, and influenza for a patient in front of you with symptoms?
So clinically, it's really hard. They present very similarly, cough, shortness of breath, you know, fever. There may be some distinguishing features from one compared to the other. You know, SARS-CoV-2, you'll have maybe a more likely loss of sense of smell or taste. You know, generalized body aches can be present with flu as well, and, you know, feeling tired, very much an overlap. And that's the reason why we have these tests to distinguish one from another, because we'll have different types of antivirals to treat flu and influenza versus SARS-CoV-2. And that's something that may evolve in the future as well for RSV. But right now, we just have to know, what can we do to protect that, you know, from that illness in the first place? And we'll just have to wait until treatments evolve to know, this is what we can do now. If you have RSV, distinguishing between those is more from a laboratory perspective. But from the standpoint of a person, you just want to prevent yourself from feeling ill and landing in the hospital. Now, of course, you want to prevent risk of dying, but then you also want to prevent everything that may happen after you're sick and recovering.
Well, thank you. And I think to emphasize again, for SARS-CoV-2 and influenza, we do have antivirals that, if used early enough, may militate or mitigate some of the morbidity. There is no such treatment in the elderly for RSV, so vaccine would be recommended as a primary prevention. When you look at this, we have obviously two new subunit vaccines, so they're not live vaccines. Can you tell us, because a lot of patients want to know, well, you know, Dr. Fector, this is new. Is it safe?
Right. And as these vaccines roll out, there's always hesitation with a new intervention, particularly if you're going to be sticking yourself with something that you feel is really not proven. You know, when these vaccines come out, and there are studies that are done to really show the effectiveness in reducing things like mortality associated with the illness, you know, morbidity associated with illness, so that's all the symptoms associated with this. They typically try to draw in individuals that represent the general population, so you know that the people who have been enrolled really are similar to who you are, and they really watch to see whether or not there are going to be any serious side effects, and watch the efficacy, and they follow these people for a long enough period of time to demonstrate that it really does the job it's supposed to. I think that more people are worried about safety and concerns about side effects, as opposed to efficacy, which is always an important factor as well. But you know, a lot of people just don't want to have any side effects. They're worried about other unintended consequences. And those are generally well studied. And the balance when you're thinking about whether or not you're going to get the vaccine is, you know, what are the risks? Because it's never a free ride. There's always a possibility of side effects. You know, mild side effects like soreness at the site of infection versus generalized body aches. And there are rare side effects as well that you have to consider. But you also have to think about the benefits. What is it going to provide for you? Reduction in risk of dying from this illness, reduction in risk of hospitalization. But then for my patients, you know, I worry about kind of downstream things that may not have been necessarily studied in the initial trials, but are top of mind for my patients. So, you know, if you have underlying cognitive impairment, there is that risk of delirium in the hospital. No, so if you get hospitalized, that confusion that can occur, most people recover from it. But individuals who have underlying cognitive impairment or dementia, they may not recover back to their baseline down the line. If you have problems with mobility already before getting sick, you think about what happens in the hospital. You're stuck in bed for a long period of time. You're going to get weaker. And more often than not, you may end up in rehab. And some of the people that go to rehab, they never recover to their prior level of physical functioning. So, you know, what are the consequences of loss of cognition and loss of physical functioning? It equates to loss of independence, more help in the home, and you know, in less frequent occasions, sometimes you can't go home and you end up going to a more supervised setting. So those are the things that I also think about when I think of my patients that end up in hospitals. So beyond what the studies actually look at, because they can't study everything, I think about these consequences in my patients that occur very frequently when they get sick from other things like heart failure or an infection, you know, cellulitis or, you know, COPD exacerbation. They're in the hospital and they'll have the same kind of consequences. And I've seen this all the time in my population. That's really what I want to try to avoid, because as a geriatrician, preserving independence is the most important thing for my patient. And if I can do something to help to preserve that and prevent that decline, it's a worthwhile intervention.
Well, thank you for that explanation. Pragmatically now, in your patient population, you know, CDC allows us to give all three jabs at once. For instance, if you wanted your COVID booster, your influenza, and in your population, it's going to be the high dose influenza, which is different than less than 65. And of course, the RSV. So in your practice, how are you generally administering these respiratory virus vaccines in the current season?
So a lot of it revolves around opportunity. If a person only sees a doctor every once in a while, and you have one chance to give the vaccines, and it's safe to give all three, I give it. Knowing and warning that person that you're more likely to get muscle aches and pains, you're more likely to get sore at that spot. You may feel, you know, tired and kind of achy for a couple of days, but it's going to recover. You're going to resolve from that. And I know that after that point, they're protected. In an ideal situation, I try to spread out the pain, so to speak, so that, you know, you have all three vaccines. You don't have to have that kind of big peak of feeling terrible for the days after the vaccine. And then there's some data that shows that when you spread out the vaccines, the efficacy may actually be better or enhanced. And so there's an argument for doing both. And that's the reason why an individualized decision and knowing your patients is important, because you know what's going to work out best for the person in front of you. Is it one time that you have the only opportunity to give them protection for all these illnesses? Or do you trust that that person will get the vaccines over time in the way that you recommend? So that's where you really have to focus on the person in front of you. But you could go either way. It's just, what's the best decision for the person who you're talking to?
Well, thank you. I think that's a nice segue into something that is now in our lexicon in vaccines, and that's vaccine hesitancy versus vaccine resistance. So, you know, I look at vaccine hesitancy as somebody who's not sure. They have not made their decision, but obviously weighs some evidence, versus those that are vaccine hesitant that maybe you're not going to get to yes, or the decision is set in stone, which is relatively minor of the patients that I see. However, I want to now, if you look at how clinicians are supposed to message, say, RSV, it's something called shared decision-making model. And I wonder if you can explain that in terms of how you put that into practice in terms of using persuasion or discussing with the patients about the RSV vaccine in particular.
Yeah, that can be a really challenging discussion to have with your patients. And the key thing is to really think about the person who's in front of you. What I often will ask when a person really doesn't want to have a vaccine is like, what's the reason why? What's the reason why you're concerned? And you want to address that concern directly with the evidence that you have available and the reasons why that person may not actually want to get vaccinated. And it may be a knowledge deficit. It may be a particular fear of a side effect. They may not be concerned about its effectiveness and not be convinced of it. But I think that you have to address that first before really moving forward. When you individualize the decision and you want to try to convince, because we can't really force a person to get a vaccine, but when you want to try to convince them that this is really going to help you, you really want to find something that would motivate that individual to say, yes, this really is appropriate for me. So again, I don't just look at the number that's next to a person, though you can say that, you know, as you get older, now if you get RSV, now you're more likely to have severe illness. And then the other thing that you want to add to that is that, you know, you may not die from it, but you're more likely to get into a hospital situation if you get sick from this. And it may not just be the age, but the medical problems that a person has. You know, if a person has underlying COPD or heart failure and the other comorbidities that are associated with poor outcomes for RSV, you can say, you know, you're going to be at risk for serious outcomes. So we want to make sure that you're protected. And this is the reason why the vaccine is effective. But then you can also think about, let's say that you end up in the hospital, you know, and you have patients that have been hospitalized before, and often they're accompanied by family members that remember what they were like in the hospital. And they may be able to recall an episode of delirium that they had in the hospital that they may or may not have been able to recover from. Or the rehab stay that occurred after hospitalization where a person really didn't do well and didn't recover completely. So they understand what hospitalization means for their family member. And that is something that often they'll want to try to avoid. And that's one more bit of information that can help you convince a person that you want to use this vaccine to protect you because these are the consequences of hospitalization that you may encounter again. Delirium and incomplete recovery from delirium. Physical deconditioning, and more loss of mobility. And then you can historically look back and say, this is what happened to you last time. You know, you were walking independently last time you were in the hospital, and now you're using a cane, or now you're using a walker, okay? You were able to drive and manage your finances and medications independently before you were hospitalized last time. Now you need help for these things. Now, and that loss of independence often is a motivating factor for people to be proactive in preventing that from happening again. Because again, this is important for that individual. I think it's a harder argument for someone who's totally healthy, who has no comorbidities. There's no convincing evidence to tell them that they're going to get benefit. Okay, so that really is a harder discussion to have. Now, but as doctors, as clinicians, we know what the data shows, and that person can still derive benefits. So you can slowly chip away at that wall over time with continued discussion, just like I have with my patients who have been reluctant to take the COVID vaccine or the flu vaccine before historically. I'll bring it up again. Every year we're going to have the discussion. You know, I'll see them again in 3 months. We can talk again. You know, it's never too late. With flu season, there's always a time that it's too late. But with RSV, we don't really know that yet. So you can go back and revisit the vaccine again in the future and take the opportunity to see if they're willing to try. Okay, it's just like you would bring up any other primary care prevention, colon cancer screening, other vaccines. It becomes kind of an annual ritual and you bring it up. And they may have had a come-to-Jesus moment at some point where they have heard about a friend or a family member that got RSV and that they were in the hospital or they had, you know, serious side effects and they don't want this to happen to them. Often that is a motivating factor for a lot of people that they know someone who was affected by an illness and now they don't want to have that happen. So you don't know what happens between the last visit with them and the next visit and they may have changed their mind. So you want to give them that opportunity to reconsider. And you'll still have the data to help you out. And you bring it up again, and you just hope next time you're successful. And then you would have done your job as a doctor.
Ronan, I like that approach. And I think I personally learned so much, obviously, through the COVID pandemic in terms of vaccine education. And I think your approach is one that I try to model after, and that's be curious as opposed to judgmental. In listening, you know, there's studies to show that physicians maybe wait an average of 10 seconds before jumping in, but really, you know, listening and obviously trying to be respectful. And then, as you said, trying to at least throw in some counterpoints. As I told some of my patients, look, I'm not advising you on changing the oil, but I do know something about infectious diseases, right? That's my hopefully bailiwick. And I like your other point about it could be a bridge to decision. It may not be this time, but it's also think about that it's not irreversible, the decision that you make or don't make today. The power of persuasion, I think, is a very good one that a lot of docs, you know, we aren't necessarily good at that. And then other things is a family unit, as you mentioned, because you might be protecting, as we say in healthcare. If you're not going to do it for yourself, then do it for whomever else is in the family. You might have more vulnerable people or small children. And as you know as well as I do, there are many studies that show that, for instance, pneumococcal vaccination of the children can help protect the grandparents and vice versa. So there's that kind of milieu, the environment we live in.
Right. Yeah, I think that's an excellent point, you know, especially if you have family members and caregivers around. They understand that, you know, if they have a family member who's vulnerable, if they get vaccinated, they're protecting them too. I think that was also something that came up during the COVID pandemic, is that individuals who cannot be vaccinated for any particular reasons, the people around them can protect them by getting vaccinated themselves. And we see that also in nursing facilities and congregate living facilities, where the staff that come in and out very frequently, and they're exposed to other persons who may be ill, they often are required to be vaccinated so they can protect the people that they provide care for as well. So that herd immunity, so to speak, is so important. And then in which case, you're not just thinking about yourself, you're thinking about the other people around you that you're protecting. And I think that's an important consideration and maybe a motivating factor for the family members who are there in attendance with your older persons to decide to get vaccinated themselves if that person refuses or for whatever reason cannot be vaccinated. So it becomes more altruistic at that point. It's less about a selfish motivation.
Well, thank you for that. As we wrap up here, I just want to also, can you help us, you know, were there other things that came out of the pandemic that help your population? And when I'm thinking about, when I see an elderly patient, you know, the transportation or the, you know, coming to the clinic. So can you tell me what your perspectives have been in terms of using telehealth or distance health in terms of touching your patients, but obviously decreasing maybe some inefficient or unnecessary transportation aspects?
Right. I mean, I think that's one of the great evolutions in medical care during the pandemic. When we were isolated, we still had to take care of our patients who had medical problems, but they were at home, couldn't see us in person. And so we've used these virtual visits as a way to connect, you know, even briefly and even spontaneously to individuals who have medical concerns, urgent issues, and I think that we've evolved to the point where it becomes easy. And even for family members, older persons who have challenges with technology, often there's younger persons who are very facile with technology, so it's not really a barrier anymore. So that those opportunities to communicate these recommendations to your patients are not necessarily blocked by the absence of one-on-one face-to-face person contact. You know, if you have the ability to actually see a person on the screen, you can communicate your opinion to them. Even a phone call, you know, as a virtual visit can still be effective because you can talk to the patient, you can talk to the family. As long as you're able to communicate your thoughts and ideas and have a discussion, it's not a barrier. You know, but even beyond that, vaccines are readily available. You just don't have to go to the doctor's office for this anymore. Any drugstore has these vaccines available. You have access to them. They'll be covered by your insurance. Often family members can plan when they can provide transportation to bring them conveniently during the weekends, after hours. You know, it doesn't have to be during the business day anymore. And you can time it so that if you're afraid to be around a lot of other people, you know when it's going to be less busy in a drugstore. So you can go and not be worried about being exposed to other individuals if you really are concerned about picking something else up. And I know that that was also a concern for a lot of my patients in going to public places. You know, would I be exposed to COVID? Am I going to get sick from COVID just by going there to get this vaccine? You know, who are the other people that are going to be sick there? And those are legitimate concerns. But, you know, you can time it so that it works out better for your schedule, for your concerns. Everything can be individualized. And I think that the availability of technology and the availability of so many sources for the vaccine just makes access so much easier.
When I listen to you, there's a philosophy that I hear on the book written by Atul Gawande about his experience with his father on being mortal, and just what is important to the patient, the patient-centered principles that you've articulated now. I wonder, is there any other books or things that you're reading that you might recommend for the audience to get better ideas in terms of actually the joys of taking care of the elderly in those experiences?
So, you know, I'm referring to Atul Gawande's book. I think that was, I think, a great example. I think more than anything else, that actually helps to highlight the individualized nature of getting older and how, as a healthcare system, we really have to change from cookie cutter to really talking about a person as an individual and thinking about the needs of that individual, the uniqueness of that individual when it comes to any medical decisions. Now, you have to make everything individualized. But then beyond that, we're really talking about a person along with their caregivers and family. So it's not just about the patient. You know, when I see patients in my clinic, there's the caregivers that are there too. You have the family members that are affected when a person is ill. When a person gets sick, these people are going to take care of them. So we just don't have to worry about the impact of a disease on that person that we're talking about in vaccination. We have to think about how is that going to impact the family members that are still working, the other members of the family that are there that may still be at risk for other illnesses, the level of care that they're going to need down the line. How is it going to affect their finances and their employment? So these are questions that go beyond just medicine. We're talking about the impact of an illness on the life of the whole family. So those are all considerations when you're suggesting something that is meant to protect the individual, is that there's long-ranging implications even beyond that person. It can affect the family, and that's how you want to view a person who's older. It's really the family unit you're thinking about, you know, who else is living with that person that the decision will affect, and not just the individual.
Well, I think that's a great way to close. Again, gratitude for my colleague, Dr. Rona Factora, for giving us a great overview of geriatric care and also the role of the RSV vaccine. Again, my name is Stephen Gordon, Department Chair of Infectious Disease. Thank you for joining us, and I wish everyone very well. Thank you so much.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Respiratory Exchange Podcast. For more stories and information from the Cleveland Clinic Respiratory Institute, you can follow me on Twitter at @RyDwakeMD.